G'day there, and welcome to our podcast, Everyone Has a Story. This is the podcast that complements our two quarterly lifestyle magazines, In Noosa Magazine and Hello Sunshine Magazine. Today's guest had a great childhood. He travelled around Australia with his parents in a bus, being homeschooled, and this ignited his adventurous spirit. It led him on to London with plans to then make it on to New York City. His passion for and interest in botany has set him off on a fascinating journey of discovery that has dovetailed into his career in hospitality as co-owner of Herbert in Noosa Junction. Everyone has a story, and today I'd like you to meet Alex McKechnie. Where did you grow up, first of all?
So I'm from Boreen Point.
You're a local boy.
Yeah. Born here. When I was young, my parents bought a bus and we drove around Australia for 2.5 years, and I was homeschooled during that segment. And then I moved to London when I was 18, got involved with the bar scene there, and then continued to travel throughout Europe and Asia and America, and learning about different things within my field and plants and botany and ingredients and what you can do with them.
I want to go right back to the you and the bus and the mum and dad and traveling around Australia. I mean, that's not really a typical kind of upbringing for a lot of kids. What do you remember about that time?
Oh, heaps. You know, that whole period was just huge for me. It was constant travel, constant new people, new phases, new scenery, new everything.
You and siblings?
Or yep, me, my brother, and my sister.
So five of you?
In this bus.
On the bus?
Yeah.
Okay. And was that something that your mum and dad had always done even before you kids came along? Or was it like a spur of the moment family decision to trek around the country?
My parents were always pretty adventurous. So we grew up like rock climbing and doing archery and, you know, scaling mountains and rapiding rivers and kayaks and things. So that was always, I think, a big part of a childhood. And then I don't really recall. I was pretty young. I was like six when we took off. But I don't really recall the process of like, hey, kids, we're gonna go. I just remember, you know, in the bus there's like a double bed at the back, and then there was a bunk bed, and then the table dropped down to make a single bed, and then they were kind of like, Alex, you sleep, your bed is like the front seats. I had the worst bed in the bus.
Yeah.
And I recall that and being like, wow, okay, this kind of sucks.
Do you recall those times as fond memories? So I imagine it would have been hard to make friends, though. Did you have...
I've always been a pretty high energy social person. So, you know, my parents would just be like, run along, Alex. And then I'd come back
like
an
easily,
hour later and be like, hey, I've got this new best friend. And they're like, okay, well, say bye to him tomorrow.
And how long were you on the road for? Was it a year? Was it longer than
that? 2.5 years.
Wow.
Yeah. So then my mum's a teacher, so she homeschooled us during that process. And, it's strange. During that period, there was kind of, we were constantly outdoors and we still had to complete our schoolwork. But the amount of schoolwork that you have to complete for like your curriculum, it's really low. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know what they do in schools, because we were like filling out all the books.
Yeah.
And we were not doing like, you know, we were just going hiking and doing fun stuff.
What was the most exciting? So did you go all of circumnavigating the whole
country? Circumnavigated the country, whole country, and then did pretty much all the way through the middle as well.
Okay.
So things like we went to Uluru and we climbed Uluru, which you can't do anymore, which is great for sure. You know, that's sacred land. But also I'm kind of very grateful to have that experience. You know, like I'm glad that people can't do that, especially tourists.
Yeah.
But it's quite nice to know
that you've done it.
Yeah, and what that the view looks like.
Yeah, yeah.
Or like, you know, in Monkey Mia in Western Australia. Now you go up there and you can like, kind of, the dolphins will swim around you, but you're not allowed to touch them. And when we were there, it was like you know, you could hold on to them, you know, right. as a kid, you know, because I was small, so
yeah.
And again, it's like, sure, I fully, you know, like, it's good that you can't do that anymore, but also very grateful for those experiences.
Yeah. What did, is this where your kind of lust for travel came from, but it's kind of always on the road, seeing new
things?
Because it is very, it's a very different upbringing to a lot of, I know people travel around with campers and RVs or whatever, but to take the kids, especially three
kids, yeah,
and homeschool them, and do you remember what the catalyst was for your parents going, hey, let's hit the road?
Honestly, they're pretty whimsical at the best of times.
Yeah. So there was no plan or...
I don't know. I imagine there is, because my mom's pretty like thorough with how she does stuff.
Yeah.
But no, I think like, you know, it's the same thing. My parents, they were living in this house, and then they looked at a map and they just rotated their finger around and they went, okay, we're going to go here today. And they went there and they went to Boring Point because they weren't living around here. And then they're in Boring Point and they saw this plot of land and they were like, it's perfect, you know? And they just, they didn't have much money. They just put down the deposit on the land.
Yeah.
But it, like, again, pretty whimsical.
Yeah. And again, what do you think that instilled in you, that this spirit of adventure, this...
Yeah, I think, you know, a big thing that I got from my parents was that you can kind of do whatever you want, but you need to be responsible for your actions and your decisions. So whatever you do, you need to own it on a certain level.
Yeah.
And so if you want to go start a business, it's like, great, do it. But you've also got to be responsible for what happens with that. And so I think I took a lot of that with me. It's like when I moved to London, you know, I didn't know anybody there.
What made you, again, was it just part of an adventurous spirit because you've been in Australia, in this continent, and then suddenly, I mean, very cosmopolitan to go to Europe. What was the desire to go to London?
I'd been working at sales. So sales was my first bar job.
Yeah, on the coast.
Yeah. And then, and I'd been there for about 3 years and I wanted to learn more about cocktails. And, you know, Noosa at the time, it was like frozen daiquiris. That was the pinnacle of cocktails in Noosa. And so I spoke to some, you know, other hospo people a bit older than me, and they were like, it's either London or New York.
Because?
Well, those are the two like major cocktail cities, you know. If you want to learn about cocktails, those are the places
to go. Is mixologist the wrong word?
You can use that if you want. I don't know. I feel like you tend a bar, you're a bartender. Oh. You know what I mean? I don't think you need any special titles for it.
All right.
Yeah, and then I was 18, so I wasn't old enough to drink in New York. And then so it became London. And then I met this guy while I was working in Rumba, in the bar underneath sales. And he was like, oh, I've got a friend who's like a talented chef. He'll hook you up a job. And so I didn't know anyone. I just went there with this email saying, hey, you know, come
see. What year was this?
2008.
Oh, so not... I forget, you're a lot younger than I am.
Yeah, I was like...
I think of these periods of time as... Okay, so here you are. You're interested in cocktails, drinks, working behind the bar, hospitality. You've explained why you've got to be 21 in the US. So here you are in London. What was that like, landing there? Again, did you travel alone? Did you go with...
Alone.
Yeah?
Yeah. It was full on. Like, I bankrupted myself pretty much immediately when I got there.
Expensive city to live in, too.
Yeah, and I'd been, you know... I was living in Noosa, so from 16 I'd been self-sufficient. I'd been living in the Junction, and I the amount that I was earning at that time as a bartender at sales, plus like I was paying my rent with my tips, and I was living a very like fun, non like consequential life.
You're only 18.
Yeah, but like, you know,
no responsibilities.
Rent was paid by tips, food was paid by tips, like my wage was quite good. I was just having heaps of fun.
Good.
And then I went to London and it was like I tried to live that similar lifestyle and then was like, no, you can't afford that, you know. And I went from living in this quite nice place
to like, oh, you have to move out and like,
okay,
you can only afford this. Like,
tell me about that reality check though. What did that make you want to do? Did you reevaluate? Did you think, shall I go back to Noosa where I'm having this?
I almost ran away. I almost ran away. And then the chef was like, oh, you're going to be one of those Aussies who just came over here and couldn't hack it. And, and so I stayed despite him, you know. I was like, yeah, I can. I can prove myself and blah, blah, blah.
Maybe he did that on purpose.
Oh, he nailed it. He fully got me good, you know. Like, it was exactly what I needed to hear in order for me to stay. And I did. And then that was really helpful. And I then, through that, kind of found this new drive of like, okay, well, what are the best bars in town? I need to be working with them. I need to be entering in competitions. I need to be approaching bartending like a lot more seriously. And so that's pretty much what I did. I got affiliated with the Match Bar Group, which at the time were kind of probably the leaders in the world. So they had,
'cause it explains to a lot of, in Europe, the hospitality industry, whether you're behind a bar or whether you're on tables, is a completely, the way it's viewed is completely different to Australia. Here it's a job for kids after school, but in Australia, in Europe, it's a career.
Yeah, and you have, I mean, especially with the more like leading edge bars, you'll have, there's competitions that you need to enter. In the group that I was affiliated with, every month they'd have a training program. So you'd have somebody from, say, a whiskey company would come and they'd give a lecture about whiskey, and then you've got a month to study whiskey, and then there's a test the next month on whiskey and a new speaker for a new category. And if you were in the bottom three places for 3 months in a row, then you just got fired. It was part of the, like,
it's tough,
the, you know, that was the conditions of working in these venues. And so that was really cool, because if you were in the top five places, you got extra perks. And so there was this like hugely competitive nature about this group. And so you wanted to know everything that you could possibly know about everything. You know, who distilled this, how they distilled it, what type of still they used, where'd they get their water from, what's their inspiration.
And why is that important? Because from a creative point of view of creating new cocktails, from what, why was that important to learn the intricacies of how it was distilled?
You want to know what it tastes like and why it tastes like that. You know, it's the same with wine. It's like, well, why do you need to know how they make the wine? It's like, well, if you're going to talk about the difference between a Chardonnay from this year and the previous year, then at some point you're going to have to talk about like the weather, what happened in the last year versus this year, you know. And you want to be talking about the soil, and you want to be talking about the vineyard and what happened, and did the winemaker change, and, you know, and what's the winemaker's philosophy. So in order for you to be able to do your job really well, you need to first know the medium that you're working with. And I think that up to a certain level, the more knowledge you have, the more access to information and then ability that you can engage with in terms of drink making. So we have like a series of kind of more classical drinks that people come in and order here, you know, martinis, Sazeracs, Manhattans, old fashions, those style of drink. And someone might come in and say, oh, I want a, you know, a dry gin martini. And you say, okay, cool. Well, let's talk about gin. What type of gin do you like? What are you into? Okay, well, if you like that, I'd like to recommend this because it has these features. And so that's where that knowledge is really important, because if you can then steer someone's experience towards something that's new, but that it's going to tie in with what they already like, then I think you can give them a more rich experience.
You mentioned botany earlier, an interest in botany. Can you explain how that kind of dovetails into your interests and your career, the career path that you've chosen? You've got to deliver it.
The fish man's coming in. How are you, mate? Thanks, mate. Appreciate that. I got really interested in lemons, and that's how it kind of started. it started off actually, there was this one day I was working and you know, you get a big box of lemons and then there was this one lemon that was like clearly the best, you know, like you looked at it and you were like, it's zest was just
Primo
like,
lemon.
it was just perfect. It was like super juicy, had a perfect amount of zest and was like, that's the best lemon of the box. And that kind of, I don't know, that engaged something in my mind where I got really curious about, you know, like if you have one lemon and then you save that one lemon for one specific drink, then that person's going to have this lemon and this lemon's made this drink that's going to be better than all of the other people's drinks, you know, only slightly.
Yeah.
But that's the kind of beauty about it is you...
The variables.
We like to believe that every drink that we make is the same, but it's not, because every drink, you know, is different.
Yeah.
There's slight fluctuations in everything.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you can talk about, like, you know, the mood of the... Like, the person making the drink, right? If the person making the drink, if they're having a crap day, and they're just not really feeling it, and they make the drink, and they go, oh, you know, versus someone who's just gone off, like, had the best date, you know, and they've come in, and they're all loved up, and they're feeling great.
Mm.
I believe that...
That translates to...
I think it does.
Yeah.
I think that there's so much contextual elements to pleasure that are outside of just the one source.
Yeah. And did you... Like, it's fascinating listening to you talk about this. Did you run into other like-minded people? Other people who thought the same as you do? That went, do you know what? There's so many variables to this.
Yeah. I had a... So with drinks, I've started off kind of, I went from coffee to wine to cocktails. And then after that, I've been kind of systematically working through different categories to learn about as much. So for example, I studied under a tea master for 2 years in London, a guy called John Kennedy, hugely knowledgeable and like really, really influential for me, because he started to explain in tea making, you call it qi, right? So qi is like the energy that is in you but also around you. And a really easy way to explain qi is, you know, if you have a beer and you have a shot of tequila, they have the same amount of alcohol, but the qi experience is very different, right? The beer is like more relaxing and conversational, while the tequila is more like energizing and uplifting. And so that, if you pay attention to those things, that kind of happens with everything. You know, there's a chi, the difference between having, you know, a gin martini versus a pina colada, right? The experience of the drinks are different. And the way that your body engages with them and the way that you emotionally engage with them is different.
And you learnt this from the tea master, is that
what
you're saying?
Yeah.
Or was this something that you, because you mentioned you were aware of the variables of the ingredients. And...
So that came afterwards. That was then like, this is a very similar time when I'm starting to get interested in plants and I'm starting to see that like, there's more to a drink than just the drink, you know? And I went pretty head first on it. So I was studying tea, and then I was looking at lemons, and I bought about 6 books on lemons and started reading like hilarious amounts of information. Booked like a trip to Sicily to go visit lemons.
Sicilian.
Oh, really?
There's a lot of lemons in...
It's great lemons in Sicily.
There's a lot of cactus down there. And what do they call it? Prickly pears and...
I like prickly pear.
Do you?
Yeah, I think it's a great ingredient.
I've never had one, would you believe it?
Really?
I had some on the farm. My dad, my kid, when he was young, ate a prickly pear, but I couldn't have too many seeds.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And you get the little needles?
Do you use them? What would you use them for?
I think the easiest way is to make like a syrup or a shrub from the fruit.
Yeah.
And then play around with that. It'd be kind of cool. I'd like to distill it, because we don't have a lot of... You know, you got like gin and tequila and blah, blah, but there's all these fruits that you could make alcohol from that we just generally don't. And I think it'd be quite an interesting alcohol.
Yeah. Put that on the list. So tell me about this journey. So the tea master. And then where did you end up? Did you go back to the US, or did you go back to the US after that?
Yeah, so during that period, I got a job with this Michelin star restaurant in East London called Viajant, which is in the Bethnal Green Town Hall. It's like a 5-star design hotel, and they had a 15-course degustation menu restaurant. And they basically gave me free rein. They were like,
What was your role at that stage?
Drinks consultant for the bar program.
And how old were you?
21. Yeah.
That's pretty young.
Yeah, it's pretty nuts. 21, and I started to learn culinary techniques. So I'm learning from these like extremely talented chefs who have worked at Noma, and have worked at El Bulli, and have worked at kind of a lot of the best restaurants around the world. And suddenly, you know, it's like, hey, if you want to make parsnip syrup, you know, how do you make that? And if you want to do this, and so suddenly the rate that I'm learning just goes like hugely up, because it's
big learning curve.
It was massive, because you have suddenly access to all of these ingredients, and how, you know, it becomes less of like, oh, I want to make a drink with carrots. Okay, I'm going to juice the carrots. It's like, no, why don't you bake the carrots first, then, you know, smoke them, then turn that into a syrup, so you have like smoked carrot syrup. And it opens up this huge amount of like, oh, well, now we can make a drink, and we can make it with that.
Does this level of, you know, your investment in your craft, because this is the first time I'm diving this deep into this particular subject, is it lost on the consumer, though, or do they understand this? How do they get to play on the same field as you, though, then to appreciate something as much as you do?
I think it's definitely not lost on the consumer, but I don't think that's you don't approach it wanting, like, expecting them to understand it ultimately. Like, people come to have a good time.
It's about your expectation.
Well, yeah.
And the creative
process. It's a creative process.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think when an artist paints a painting, they're not doing it hoping that the person who looks at it feels the same way as
they did when they did it. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I think it's quite similar to that, in that people want to have a good time.
Yeah.
They're not sitting there going, wow, I wonder how they got this.
I wanted to understand this relationship, but comparing it to an artist that paints is a good... I wanted to understand your investment in it, and then kind of the consumer's appreciation. But that's a good way of doing it. You're doing it as a creative outlet.
Yeah. And I think a big part of it's like the process of discovery. Mm. So, for example, we had I had a research lab in London, and we were just working on...
A research lab?
Yeah.
Where was this set up?
This was set up in Hackney Wick.
Yeah.
It's called Fraction Flavors. It was a consulting company that basically we developed flavors and did research for bigger brands on their products.
Right.
And so we would work through different ingredients and processes and look at how we could manipulate or change them. And that's the process of discovery, where if you take red rose petals and you put them in the blender with a bunch of water and you blitz it, it turns like the most fantastic royal purple, like beautiful color.
Okay.
If you add anything acidic to that, it oxidizes and turns neon pink. If you carbonate it, it goes completely colorless, and there's no like remaining pulp or anything. It just, the color just completely emits. If you freeze that, it turns blue. If you defrost that, it turns green. So you have this thing where you go, okay, rose petals, what can we do with rose petals? And the more that you dive into it, the more that you're like, well, actually, you know, there's a huge amount of scope for the way that you could manipulate that ingredient. And I think the real key to enjoying the craft is that journey of discovery. It was of like looking into things and saying, okay, well, you know, we do something here which is called super juice. It's a quite modern technique, and it allows you to make lemon juice taste better and also way more sustainable because you're using pretty much all of the lemon versus just juicing it and throwing it away.
That's fascinating. And so how, from London at this level, researching, what brought you back to Australia?
I was moving to New York. That was my goal. I had a project which I was starting in New York, and I wanted to come home and spend a bit of time with the family and do all my visa work here. Mm-hmm. And then I was, moving to, I was literally 5 days away from moving to New York when COVID, they locked their borders. And then it was suddenly, you know, a lot more challenging. And then the opportunity to open Herbert came along.
How did that opportunity come up?
I was out sailing with Leon, and we were just talking about...
Leon was at Light Years at the time?
We were both at Light Years.
Oh, you were at Light Years, yeah, right, okay.
And we were out sailing, and we were just talking about what we like in a venue, you know? Just,
what, and what was that?
I like to feel comfortable. That's a big thing for me. And I like to feel, I'm pretty simple as a, like, easily pleased. If you give me a glass of water and smile, those are like the two things I look for. If I get those two, I'm like, whatever, I don't really mind. But, I want to feel comfortable, and I want to feel like I'm allowed, you know, some restaurants I find are a bit too snobby. And I don't think you really have fun.
It's funny you should say that. We're talking about New York. We've just come back from New York. Mm-hmm. We spent 25 days over there. And, we just accidentally stumbled across down by, I think, the start of Brooklyn Bridge, French restaurant. I think it was maybe called Le Gratin or something like that. And it was very snobby. Lots of, you know. And when you walked in there, you know, lots of the subway tiles. But nobody looked like they were having fun.
No.
All the tables were really...
Serious.
Serious.
Yeah.
And so we walked in there with a 13-year-old and, it was...
And did you enjoy yourself?
Well, the food was good and the service was good, but everybody looked miserable.
Yeah.
Which was maybe, you know, what you've got to be comfortable. I like a fun atmosphere or...
It's an experience.
Yeah.
And the experience starts the moment that you walk in the door. And I think that for me personally, guest experience is paramount. So... When you have someone and they say, oh, well, the food was good and the service was good, but it was okay. You know, then you go, okay, well, wasn't that good? Because if you're still saying it's okay.
Yeah.
You know, while if someone leaves and they say, wow, that was so much fun. I really enjoyed that.
What do you place as paramount? Because for me, and we're big foodies, even if the food's not up to standard, if the service is outstanding, that's still... talkability. You'll still tell someone, do you know what? You'll forget about the food, but you'll say, you know, the service at the place is amazing.
Guest experience.
That's were friendly. They were guest experience. Yeah.
I think that's... So we did a pop-up bar in London, and when we were... This is towards the end of my time there, myself and a friend, and we were trying to get the license for the venue, and it was just... It was such a headache. It was virtually impossible unless we gave them like $100,000, and we didn't have $100,000 to give them, so we were looking at all the options, and eventually we just said, well, what if we make everything free, so this bar is completely free, and at the end of the guest's experience we present a really nice paper envelope and we say, hey, look guys, everything's free. If you want to put some money in here, you can, but you are by no means required to. Everything is free.
Wow. So was that green lit? Did you say it, did it go ahead?
It was called the Guinea Pig Club. We ran that for just under a year.
Wow.
We made more money that way than if we had charged people. And it really nailed in that philosophy of guest experience. Because if everything's free, then when someone leaves, they need to be saying, oh, that was so good.
Would that work here?
Maybe. You'd be surprised. Well, people are good.
Why do you think it worked there? What was the ingredient? Was it a different, culturally different?
Particularly in Noosa, I think that there's this stigma of how you go about drinking and when you're out and doing things. And I think that there's the, like, the Friday and Saturday night things, but then for the most part, I think middle of the week, people just kind of, they just want to drink and they're not looking to go out and have like an experience.
Yeah, yeah. Obviously you got numbers in London. It's a bigger turnout. Yeah, right, I understand.
And we were only a 12-seater venue, so it was very intimate.
Yeah.
You know, so for example, on our first week, we had hot towels on arrival.
Yeah.
And our second week, we had eucalyptus-scented hot towels. And so we're constantly evolving it and changing it. By the end, you know, with the floor team, it was like, if you're talking to someone and you say, hey, how was your day? Or, pretty stressful. Like, okay, do you want a 5-minute back massage? Like, we would look at any possible way to improve someone's experience.
Yeah,
that
right.
could be like anything.
Yeah.
Telling dad jokes, giving them little coupons or extra things.
So this, it was only a pop-up, so it had a limited...
Yeah, so I had a friend who had a venue,
and
the venue was, it finished at around 3 o'clock or something like that.
Yeah.
And it was really nice, like minimalistic design inside.
Yeah.
And so to then just do a cocktail bar in the evening in that space was, it was really, really good.
So from that when you're in Leon and Sailing, you're talking about what's the ultimate experience?
Mm.
Have you achieved it here with Herbert?
I think so. Yeah. Leon said that he wanted Herbert to be like you were having a dinner party inside his house.
Right.
And if you watch the way that Leon walks around and engages with people and sits down, and I think that's very much, it's pretty much on the head of like what we spoke about. I think it's great. I really, I like the atmosphere and the feel that you get from dining in Herbert. I think it's very comfortable and very warm.
Understanding your background from traveling around on the bus, travels across Europe, you had, I guess it's still an unfulfilled desire to go to New York.
Mm-hmm.
Have you put roots down here, or is these are still things that you want to do?
Oh yeah, no, I don't think I've got roots here. I need to probably leave pretty soon.
How's that going to work?
I will figure it out. It's always.
But you're the man behind the bar, aren't you? So you're.
We've got a really strong integral bar team.
Oh yeah.
Our bar team's solid.
Yeah.
Like I recently took some time off and. You know, I was away for, I think, like 3 weeks or something. And I came back and it was like,
okay,
perfect.
So you've got that flexibility to...
Bar teams are really strong. Actually, our whole team, you know?
Did you blow their mind the first time? Because you were blowing my mind listening to you talk about the variables and the intricacies of the ingredients. And the first time you spoke... Well, how old is your bar team, for example?
Between 18 and 25.
And you remember the first time you were... teaching them or training them, or
I mean, we're still training.
Talking to them about the things that you have learned.
I don't think I really sit down like this.
No, but I mean, you know, it's pretty. I've never heard this stuff before. The detail that you've gone into.
I think like the way that we talk about drinks in the bar is very much you call them specs, right? Your cocktail recipes are specs. So whenever we're talking about things, we talk about like ratios and formulas. So you know,
a science lab.
It's a recipe, right?
Yeah.
So you'd be like, well, this is, you know, like 60-30-30. And then we'll talk about balancing things and new ingredients, and I present them with challenges to invent new drinks. And, you know, everyone has something that they want to get out of this in their own way when they work here.
Mm.
You know, some people just want to come in, make the drinks, go home, do that. Other people want to learn and want to get really good at making particular drinks. And so for me, it's more about finding what triggers each staff member and engaging with them on that level.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we've got a young guy, Rocco, who's just super talented, and he really likes inventing new drinks. So I'll be like, okay, you know, and I'll present him a tough drink to make, you know, like, I want you to make with these ingredients. And the stuff that he comes up with, it's fantastic. Like, really, he's 18. And the drinks that he's making now are like...
You fired his imagination?
Oh, he's
what,
killing it.
What does he want to say?
Super impressive, honestly. Yeah. Some of the drinks, like, I've thrown him some terrible ingredients and been like, in my head, you know, like, haha.
On purpose?
Yeah.
To trick him up?
Yeah, just...
Or do you think there's a palatable outcome? To what
in my mind, not so much.
No.
And then he makes something and you're like, whoa, actually, this is, like a really good drink.
Yeah.
So now, I don't know. I'm really interested in people and how you engage with people and how you inspire them and what they want out of this relationship.
Yeah.
And I think if you can find that and a middle ground between what you want, then... You create a workspace in which people are happy, you know?
Mm.
And I think that reflects in our, like, staff turnaround. We've had...
High retention.
Of the people, like, on the floor that we've lost, I think we lost, like, three staff members since we've opened on the floor, and two of them have come back.
Oh, okay.
So it's like... Yeah.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Alex McKechnie was my guest on today's episode of Everyone Has a Story. If you enjoyed the podcast and you feel you'd like to share it about on your social media platforms, please feel free to do so. Until next time, take care.